This is Martin Luther King Jr. talking about the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955.
When we planned the bus boycott, we said if we could just get about 50 or 60% of the Negroes of Montgomery not to ride buses, this would be an effective boycott. I think that whole day we found 8 Negroes on the buses.
That was the auspicious beginning of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, better known as the SCLC. Martin Luther King himself was the first leader of that organization, and he remained its leader until his death in 1968. While the SCLC was famous for highly publicized sit-ins and marches, the NAACP, that's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, pushed for legal victories in the courtroom. Right now, the Kansas City chapters of both organizations are under new leadership. So today, on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to find out what the SCLC and NAACP are up to as a new era of protest gets underway. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'd like to welcome the SCLC of Kansas City's new president, Reverend Vernon Howard, to the show. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So when you hear Martin Luther King Jr. talking about the impact of the Montgomery bus boycott, does it strike you as relevant in some way to the work you're called to do for the SCLC today?
Without a doubt. The issue of economic justice is what Dr. King was referring to, and using economic withdrawal in cases where there is social injustice, in cases where there is economic injustice.
So economic withdrawal, just not giving your money to someone.
Absolutely. In that case in which Dr. King referred to, bus boycott, that was actually spurred by the Montgomery Improvement Association, which spurned and spawned into the development of SCLC, as you mentioned. So the issues of economic justice are still relevant today and part of our agenda.
What would you say is the legacy of that boycott in terms of the identity of the SCLC as an organization?
I think that the notion of a, shall we say, fragmentation between the care of the soul and the care of the human body and the human life. Dr. King's theology and philosophical approach was that if you care for a person's soul and tend to their navigation to heaven without creating just systems and adjust policies and legislation that care for them while they are here. In other words, Jesus put it this way, God, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So I think it really shattered notions of a fragmented theology that we
like
can...
Like a previous idea that maybe if you're suffering on earth, that's okay because you're going to go to heaven and everything's going to be fine. This is a dramatically different interpretation.
It is absolutely not okay. It is the theology that the slave master tried to give to us 100 years prior, actually 200 years prior to Dr. King's boycott of the Montgomery bus transit system. That was shattered, and we continue to operate in a theological understanding today.
How is today's SCLC different from the SCLC at that moment of its inception?
Different, I think, in that now the organization is national. There are chapters all over the country virtually. I think also different that we are grappling now with a new kind of sophisticated, an obscure, almost ambiguous, kind of sneaky kind of racism and racial discrimination that we in turn have to be very sophisticated with. Then racism was blanket. Racial discrimination was overt. Now it can be covert, and now is returning to be more overt. You have right now in this country a president and leader who mocks persons with disabilities, Yale's obscenities at women and increasingly advocates for alliances with those who are racist and stokes racism and defies the very constitution of this United States of America and its principles of inclusion of all in a legal and democratic process. These are overt ways in which we must continue to confront and oppose racial discrimination, exclusion, and economic exploitation.
So I hear you saying, I guess, that although racism now can be covert and that requires a different approach, that's not all it is.
What we have seen in the last year or two is an extreme backlash against racial inclusion, against racial diversity, and against economic justice and equality. The winds of racial diversity and the winds of economic justice are blowing from the grassroots of this country and in streets all over the nation. The rise for a living wage, the rise for equal pay for women, the rise for acknowledgement of persons with physical disabilities to be included and acknowledged as fully human. All of these streams of justice, as Amos mentioned, they're rolling down like waters, like a righteous and mighty stream. And there's a backlash against that in this country that was actually manifested, I believe, in this last presidential election. But I believe firmly that might, in terms of politically and economically, will not win. Right in the end will win. And I think justice and racial inclusion and unity and peace will be the norm.
Well, I'd like to also bring Reverend Rodney Williams into this conversation. He is the new president of the NAACP of Kansas City. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to me about the history of the NAACP, both nationally and locally.
Well, the NAACP was formed in the year 1909 in New York City as a result of the race riots in Springfield, Illinois.
What were those race riots responding to?
To the inequities that was in America at this time and the inequities that are in America today. And so therefore, even though we're some hundred and some years later, we are still dealing with and facing some of the same inequities that we were facing over a century ago.
What are some specific parallels you draw?
One of the parallels is the lack of economic stability. You still have one group of people that have or own most of the wealth in America, while you have another group of people that don't own that much land. We also have the fact that education in America is not on an equitable basis for all people. Your zip code that you live in, the tax basis that you are paying, determines the quality of education that your children get. And so the NAACP from the very beginning has been standing and fighting against that, and we are fighting those same issues today.
How do you see the histories of the NAACP and SCLC being both similar and maybe distinct?
I think that we are similar in the fact that we are fighting for the same goals. The NAACP, deals a lot with policy issues, where the SCLC has done more demonstrations. But we need to work even closer together. We've always worked together. I don't think that this battle can be won with just the NAACP without SCLC. SCLC cannot win the battles without the NAACP, as well as other community organizations that have like minds that are looking for justice and equity for all people.
You've mentioned that the struggles that inspired the NAACP to get up off the ground in the first place in 1909, that those are still struggles that you see taking on a new character maybe today, but being the same struggles. And I understand what you're getting at, but it kind of surprises me because the history of the NAACP, I guess I would think that that you would want to see that history as having made really demonstrable gains.
Yes, we have made great strides, but as Dr. Howard has stated, that this new presidency and has helped to turn the clock back. The fact that the Voting Rights Act has been gutted. When you have the Voting Rights Act that has been gutted, you have stripped the people with away from power and the access to vote so their voices can be heard.
Can you explain that a little more? How has the Voting Rights Act been gutted?
The Voting Rights Act has been gutted. For example, Missouri had just passed this new ID, voter ID law, which we believe by evidence that it is targeted at keeping poor and minorities from voting so that their votes cannot be counted, so that then it cannot be heard, so that only a certain group of people can maintain the power.
You've already gotten into this a little bit, but are there struggles that you haven't mentioned already that you think would consider the most urgent struggles of our own time and sort of the domain of the NAACP to fight in these struggles?
Well, let me answer it this way. The NAACP has what we call our game changers, and we have six game changers. One is economic stability. Two, making sure that every person can get a free and quality education. We want to make sure that all individuals in America have access to affordable health care. We want to make sure that public safety and criminal justice is at the forefront. And, of course, Voting Rights Act. And we also are looking very strongly at expanding our youth and young adult engagement.
What does that mean?
Which one? The youth and young adult engagement?
Yeah.
It is impossible, I believe, for us to continue in this new era without the millennials being with us. And so we have to become more aggressive and bring them into the fold, have them help us to shape policies and the goals for the future.
So I guess, I mean, it's interesting to think about whether sort of historic organizations with a history behind them, what those have to offer that maybe a new organization born of a new time might not. And I'd like both of your thoughts on that because I think maybe there's a tension there as far as young people go.
I think there is a tension there, but I think what both have to understand is not one or the other. It has to be the both. You have to have the SCLCs, you have to have the NAACPs, the older, more established organizations, but we cannot discount new organizations that are coming, what they bring, new ideas and new thoughts.
What do these older organizations bring that's necessary?
Well, you opened the show with identifying Dr. King's words during the Montgomery Improvement Association. Now, understand that in Montgomery, Alabama, at that time, the NAACP was already present and active. In comes Dr. King, 25, 26 years old, already a PhD, had been to Boston University, had been to Morehouse, was accomplished academically, was a new pastor of the Dexter Baptist Church, and there in that city was in fact embraced by the mainstay civil rights leadership, and was supported in his voice and movement to actually take leadership in that movement and lead it forward. What you have, as Dr. Williams says, is a convergence then of generations, a unity of both NAACP, whom Rosa Parks was a part of. And so you have a unity of civil rights organizations. You have a unity that is intergenerational. And you have a cause of economic justice. And so these little trite kind distinctions really don't have a place in the movement, and we're going to be effective.
So you think that it's just important for both of these things to exist, for the older organizations to keep moving along, keep doing what they're doing, and for younger people to start their own things, but maybe turn to you and you turn to them? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, there's only one thing, and that's the cause for justice. And so if new organizations and entities arise to speak and voice, they should not be disjointed or separate from the flow and movement of justice. All of us have those same concerns.
And what we have to be careful of is to not fall prey to divide and conquer strategies that try to keep us apart. If we fall prey to that, we're doing exactly what the enemy wants to happen. And so we have to come together, not on some levels, but on every level. It doesn't mean that I have to lead everything. Sometimes I might have to lead from the back and not from the front. And so we have to make room at the table for all people.
Might I say, and I think an illustration of that, in August of this year, the Missouri Supreme Court ordered the city of Kansas City, Missouri, to place a living wage ordinance on the ballot in Kansas City, Missouri, that Dr. Williams, as the director of religious affairs for NAACP, was a petitioner on. I, as president of SCLC, was involved in drafting the ordinance to get it done. There were labor workers and unions that were part of the advocacy. There were neighborhood groups and political clubs in the inner city that went out and got the signatures. There was a city councilman representing the 3rd District that pushed the ordinance. And so this kind of collaboration is necessary to make things happen. And now Kansas City must vote on whether the working poor receive that living wage.
Reverend Williams, yeah. I was looking at the website for the NAACP, and it kind of surprised me to see initiatives addressing climate change and environmentalism. There was a compelling argument written on the website for the idea that these issues are not separate from racial equality. I'm interested in your take on that. Talk to me about environmentalism and what it has to do with race.
Let me say this. It has a lot to do with race, because so often you find that toxic waste dumps I put in poor communities, seeps into the water, all types of cancer is the result of what's happening to these poor people as a result of these toxic dumps being placed in their community. So therefore, it is an issue of race.
You know, I'm interested in the personal histories that you guys bring to the work that you do. Reverend Williams, tell me a little bit about yourself and your background and what it is that you bring to the NAACP.
I grew up in the Bronx, New York. And as soon as school was out, my brother and I were shipped to the northeastern part of North Carolina, where my grandfather was a grassroots social activist. And from the time of about 7 years old, we were indoctrinated into the NAACP. I used to go with my grandfather to try to get signatures and try to get people to go out. At this time, they were still integrating the schools. So I was with him firsthand, going out from door to door, trying to get the African-American community to go into what they called the white school, but it was an integrated school. And I never forget, as a young child, seeing the trepidation on some of their faces, because they were threatened that if you bring your children to this school, you're going to lose your job, someone in your family is going to get hurt. And so those things never left me. And I think those things helped to shape who I am.
Is the work today, I mean, I'm just curious about this, in the era of so much happening online, do you get that same face-to-face, maybe confrontation or just exchange?
Yes, we do. And the reason that we do is because we have hit the streets. And whenever you're demonstrating in the streets or protesting in the streets, there's going to always be that type of opposition. And so, yes, I have received that.
I'm interested in your background too, Reverend Howard. I mean, tell me, where are you from?
I'm a native son of Kansas City. Product of the Kansas City, Missouri public schools, spent time growing up with my footprint across Prospect, Linwood Boulevard, Indiana, Paseo, Troost Avenue. So I'm homegrown, educated here and grew up here, and have seen over the years the kind of development and progress that has taken place in certain part of the area, and have seen firsthand my own self how there are other sectors of the community which have been virtually abandoned, in some ways divested from, and in many ways have been left to fend for themselves without proper governmental, civic, or private support. And so I'm a product of this community. I feel like I own it, and I know I love it.
Well, you're both reverends, and I'm curious about what faith has to do with social and political struggles for racial equality. There's a whole tradition behind pastors and reverends and people of, you know, clergy leading these kinds of organizations. And I'm interested in that. I mean, personally, for you, how do these things connect?
Well, for me, they're interwoven because I'm a part of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which is a Christian denomination. And it is my perspective that you cannot accurately preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and not preach about the social injustices that are taking place within our city. And so for me, to preach the gospel is to preach social justice. And so, yeah, I just think it is a part of who we are and what we do.
Well, the coming out statement of Jesus of Nazareth, the one who is the author and finisher of our faith from a Christian standpoint, is informative here. He gives a social and economic preamble to his ministerial manifesto. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He has anointed me to preach the gospel that Dr. Williams talks about so eloquently to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, the recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised. This has the motif of emancipation, the motif of mercy and compassion and servitude toward those who are imprisoned or oppressed or who are shackled or chained by any kind of physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual binding. This is central to our faith.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll continue this conversation with the new leaders of the Kansas City chapters of the NAACP and the SCLC. If you have questions for the reverends or a suggestion for what their organization should be tackling in our city today, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Reverends Rodney Williams and Vernon Howard, the new presidents of the NAACP and the SCLC of Kansas City, both under new leadership. You can call 816-235-2888 to tell them what you think their organization should be tackling right now, or to ask them a question about where they're headed in the future. Reverend Howard of the SCLC, good morning again.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Reverend Williams of the NAACP, hello to you too.
Hello, good morning.
So right now, we've kind of touched on this, but I want to hear in a little more detail. You hear a lot on the one hand about how far America has come in terms of racial injustice and racial justice, I should say. And on the other hand, you hear people lamenting that we're still dealing with this, that, or the other. And there are a lot of this is that and others. I mean, what's your take? Is it both? Is it?
I think it's both. Certainly, we cannot deny that there have been gains made in America along the racial divide. But certainly, we are nowhere near where we need to be. Dr. King dreamed of this beloved community. And that beloved community is definitely not a reality in America today. One of the reasons that I think this has taken place is because we have what I like to refer to as a politics with no compassion. Policies have been set up that do not have the least of these in mind. And as long as we have legislators that are catering to big gun lobbyists and not looking out for the people in their own hometowns, in their cities, and in their districts, we're going to have some of the same things that we're getting right now, and that is a politics with no compassion. And therefore, those individuals who are the least economically vulnerable are the ones that always suffer and carry the greatest load in that particular fight.
I think that Dr. Williams is right, and that an illustration of a such progress and yet at the same time the paradox of such stagnation is the examination of the political cycle over the course of let's say the last 150 years. 1863 through 1865, the Civil War, the freedom of the slaves, the emergence of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that supposedly brought full freedom and citizenship to all citizens, particularly African Americans. And then 60 years later, about 1918, 1920, under Woodrow Wilson, we're still dealing with the notions of Reconstruction, still dealing with desegregation, still dealing with intimidation of African Americans, still dealing with lack of jobs, decent housing, and equality. 60 years after the Civil War ends. Then 1963, get this now, I Have a Dream speech. 1965, Civil Rights Act. 1964, Voting Rights Act. All of these advancements then, check this now, laws still need to be made 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Civil War. And now fast forward to 2018, 2020, not a Woodrow Wilson, but a Donald Trump. We're still needing now to not reconstruct, but also reconstruct and deconstruct still some of the racist attitudes and some of the blockages against our freedoms still.
I want to bring this a little more local. And since you are from Kansas City, I'm curious about how you would translate some of these things to what you've witnessed in Kansas City as far as like the race relations of your youth and what you see and experience today.
Absolutely. So Kansas City right now is like two cities. There is one city that is characterized in name and label by Brookside, by Power and Light District, by Waldo, by Country Club Plaza, by Southtown and Northtown, that is prosperous, that is economically booming, that is filled with construction projects, adequate schooling, safe neighborhoods, decent housing, booming economy. There's another city within the core that is characterized by the label of inner city or central city. What is it identified by? Crime, violence, drug addiction, diminished housing values, the implicit and explicit kinds of messages through infiltration of drugs and guns and gangs. And get this, still schools, public schools, struggling to be accredited and to adequately develop minds and hearts to compete in an unjust system. We have two cities in Kansas City right now.
So how does your organization tackle that? I mean, yeah.
Well, one of the things that we're doing is the newly devised, by the grassroots of the urban core, the 1/8 cent Central City Redevelopment Project, which will actually be on the ballot on April the 4th, the anniversary of Dr. King's assassination in 1968. When he was advocating for, guess what, fair pay and workers' rights for sanitation workers down in Memphis, Tennessee. On that day, April 4th of this year, Kansas City electorate will have the opportunity to come to the polls and vote for a Central City Development Project that will actually give leverage funds, investment dollars to development in that second city, that darker city, that forgotten city that is in the core of the more vibrant Kansas City.
I'm sure we'll be having lots of conversations on KCUR exploring the merits of that and also maybe arguments against it. We'll be exploring that as it gets closer. But Reverend Williams, what are your thoughts about Kansas City today and what the particular issues we face are and whether there are particular tactics that need to be employed to deal with those?
Well, as a person that did not grow up in Kansas City, I was really startled at the divisiveness of the city. One of the things I think that we have to consistently attack, and that is to make sure that our children are receiving a quality education. The way I believe that we can go about doing this is by helping the superintendent, the new superintendent, all of our the school boards and everyone else who is involved, to help them to see that education that is second class cannot be tolerated in Kansas City. We have to have a first class education in Kansas City. And so therefore, I think that the SCLC, NAACP, and all like-minded organizations have to come together and have a united front and demand quality education for our children.
You know, when it comes to both of the issues you guys have brought up, like the idea that we are a divided city, divided by race and economics, as well as the idea that our school systems, our public school systems, could be serving people at least differently, if not better. I'm interested, you know, people talk about these things all the time. I don't think there's a lack of interest in changing those things, but I don't know if anyone's sort of cracked the code for how to do it.
I don't want to say that we've cracked the code, but I think it was 2 years ago when the city was facing totally non-accreditation. It seems that the highest educator in the state wanted to make their entire school system a charter system. Many groups in Kansas City came together, stood up, fought, and said, no, we want quality public education. As a result of that, they were able to have an opportunity to look again. They did receive provisional accreditation. They're on their way now, I believe, to become an accredited district. And that is because the people came together. And it was not one group of persons, but it was a collective group of grassroots people coming together, expressing their voices. And so I think that is the secret, that when people of all different hues, economic backgrounds will come together and voice their concern and keep voicing their concern and understanding that it's not going to be a quick fix, but it's going to be a long fight, I believe we can win any issue that comes before us.
I'm also curious about your thoughts on the role of race within other social justice movements that aren't specifically intended to further racial equality, but that movements that see themselves as either progressive or forward-thinking in some way. There's a lot of criticism these days of how people of color are treated within those organizations, or whether their concerns are heard, or more popularly, I guess you'll hear talk of white privilege within social justice movements. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Gina, you ask what SCLC is doing to alleviate economic injustice and bring economic parity. And I mentioned to you the Central City Redevelopment Project. You say to me that the radio station will, in fact, move forward and talk about the pros and the cons. Here's the thing that we must understand, that economic investment in communities is the core to development of that community. If there is economic development in parity and equity, then schools are stronger, teachers can be paid better, which means there is a better quality of education and teachers that are drawn. Infrastructure is better. Health services are provided, new construction that provides jobs and housing. So we must understand that economic investment in these communities is the core, and that's what the Central City Development Project is trying to do.
I'd like to pivot to you also, Reverend Williams, just on this idea of race within other social justice movements, or maybe more umbrella kinds of social justice movements?
I think that race, again, is still the dividing line in America. I don't believe that you could look at any social justice movement and not see racism. If race is taken out of the equation, I think you're missing the whole ballpark. Oftentimes, you spoke of white privilege. Oftentimes, those who have white privilege don't want to talk about white privilege. They don't want to see that their skin color provides them with access that is denied by other people. And so one of the things I think that the NAACP has to do, has been doing, and has to continue to do, is to make sure that all people have equal access and equal protection under the law.
Reverends, thank you both so much for being here today. Reverend Rodney Williams is president of the NAACP of Kansas City, and Reverend Vernon Howard is the president of the SCLC of Kansas City. Coming up, The Art of Peter Volkus, a rebel in the world of ceramics. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. A recent article in the New York Times began this way, calling Peter Volkus a ceramist is a bit like calling Jimi Hendrix a guitarist. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and now we're going to learn about Kansas City's apparent rock star rebel in the world of clay, Peter Volkus. He's no longer with us, so we will be hearing his story from the people who knew him. Sherry Leedy, good morning.
Good morning.
How did you know Peter Volkus?
Well, I was trying to remember how I originally met Peter Volkus, and it's sort of like trying to remember when you first saw the sunshine or the wind blow. It just seemed like he was always there, and certainly when I was a student at the Kansas City Art Institute in 1974, he came and did a very famous workshop in the ceramics department. And so I'm sure I was aware of him at that time.
What was famous? Why was this workshop famous?
Well, I guess it probably wasn't famous at the time. It's sort of well known now because someone had the foresight to video it, and it's on. You can sort of see it in its entirety on YouTube. So I was a student. Peter was also, you know, was a very well-known artist. So, you know, I didn't know him, you know, in that sense. But later, when I married another ceramic artist, they were friends. And so Pete would come and visit and stay at our house and work at our house and so on. So I really became friends with him, got to know him.
Were you surprised to see the New York Times calling him the Jimi Hendrix of ceramics, essentially?
No, not at all. That's what all of us who knew him have always known. He was a great improvisational artist. He was a pioneer. You really can't speak of ceramics in the 20th century without thinking of Peter Volkus.
You know, one of the things in this New York Times article that kind of intrigued me, and you see it when you look at his work, that it doesn't look like you think of pots in ceramics as being empty vessels that have kind of, I don't know, they might be heavy, but they have a lightness to them. Mm-hmm. In that you imagine that there is this empty inside, and you don't get that sense when you look at his work. You get this sense of stuff kind of coming out of it, dense stuff coming out of his pots. And I don't even know if you would call them pots. You know, and the story that they tell is that one of his fellow ceramics teachers had coined the phrase "lift and life" to describe the qualities of an ideal pot, and that he had responded with his own mantra, which was "dump and death."
Well, very early on in the 1950s, early 1950s, he did make those very beautiful, very what we would think of as more traditional pots that were thin, that were more functional, that were inspired by Scandinavian and Japanese ceramics. But in, I believe, 1953 or 54, he did a teaching stint at Black Mountain College, where John Cage, Rauschenberg, Karen Carnes were there, and for the first time,
the leaders of the avant-garde at the time.
Correct. And for a guy from Montana who'd been a gunner in World War II, it was eye-opening. It was the first time he'd ever heard a poetry reading, the first time he'd ever seen a modern dance performance. And the ideas that were in the air at the time really impacted him and changed his work forever.
Well, I want to turn to someone else who knew Peter Voulkos really well. His longtime assistant is with us. John Balestrieri joins us from the University of Bowling Green in Ohio. Hi, John.
Hello.
What exactly did you do as Peter Voulkos' assistant? I'm not sure what an assistant to a ceramist does exactly.
Well, I became his assistant when he was rather late in life, about the last 5 years of his life. I had fired some of his work prior to that, but during the last 5 years, I basically threw large blanks of clay, and then those would get converted into either platters or stack forms that he's well known for. And then I would assist him in putting those pieces together, and I would basically work on the inside of things and stitch things together so that they worked technically and would hold up in the kiln and so forth and not collapse.
Now, can you describe in a little more
detail on the outside?
Describe in a little more detail what a stack was.
Well, basically, it's this was just a term that he used for these forms, and they originated from a traditional bottle shape. And basically, he's taking rings of clay, putting them on top of each other, and then it sort of collars in towards the top, and then there's a neck on top of that. So they loosely resemble a bottle form, but they're
except
much
they're dense.
Larger. Up to, they're very thick, but they are hollow, and there's often holes penetrated through them, which he used to say he was letting the dark out.
And, instead of letting the light in,
so they're quite heavy. But I think the reason they were heavy is because that the thickness of the thing allowed for a much greater kind of interface between himself and the material. He could dig into it, pass through it, come out of it, add chunks onto it, and so forth. So. It was much more like building sculpture or working on a painting than throwing a delicate pot.
You know, Sherry has referenced his sort of live workshops or like borderline performances, and you don't think of ceramics artists kind of working for an audience like in terms of process. What was it like to watch him work? Why was Peter Voulkos' process entertaining enough to captivate an audience?
Well, they were. I mean, that's basically how he worked and when he worked. During the time that I knew him, we always worked in front of an audience. I think there's something to do with the pace of how he worked. I think a lot of people think that this abstract expressive energy is just this thing that happens immediately or instantly or violently or something like that. And it's really not like that. It's more methodical and step by step. And it's a progression. And so I think it's fascinating for people to see 1,000 pounds of clay just sitting there in a block and slowly be converted into this giant form that this person has interfaced with over a period of, let's say, 5 days to 7 days. And you just watch the transformation of the material as this dialogue happens between the artist and the material. It's mesmerizing in its own way.
There also seems to be a piece of it, though, that is charisma. And you think, I mean, at least I think in the visual arts of the end result kind of standing on its own. It's an object. And I don't think necessarily, when I think of charisma in the visual arts, I think of it as the object almost that needs to have charisma. But it seems that Peter Voulkos himself as a character had a certain amount of charisma that was part and parcel of his role as an artist in this city and beyond. Sherry, can you talk to me about that?
Well, Pete's final product is the end result of a very physical performance. And it's as if he and the material are the same. And so what you're left with is as much about him personally as it is about the object itself. So they're intertwined, they're the same thing, and really that's what he was always striving for. And now we're left with the end result, which is the object, the sculpture, and every time I see one, I still see Pete.
John, talk to me a little bit about him as, I don't know, like this charisma piece of it is interesting to me, but what is it about, I mean, the rebellious piece is interesting too. You've talked about that he's someone who wanted to let the dark out, and that implies to me that that's coming, there's something coming from him as a person, not just an artistic mission, but, you know, this idea of darkness. And what do you know about him and what motivated him?
Well, he is, I mean, you use the word charisma. I mean, he was incredibly charismatic. And I think you have to look at who he was physically just to encounter him physically was sort of a, you know, he's a very kind of imposing figure, an unusual figure to encounter physically.
Describe him. Can you describe him?
He's a large barrel-chested man. He had long gray hair. He walked very, very, very slowly with his toes slightly pushed together, and kind of moved around really slow. In fact, if you start walking with him, no matter what, he would always slow down. He would walk slower to you until you found yourself at a complete stop. I mean, he was always interested in the set, in the moment that he was with you. And so this physical presence that you encounter is counterpointed right away by him asking you about your life. You know, he would just start to become involved with whoever it was that he was talking to. And it didn't matter if it was the waitress at the restaurant or some other famous artist or whatever, whoever was in the room at the time that was talking to him. You know, he was in the moment with that person. And I think that that's very compelling. And so the people that would be around him in a workshop would be seduced by that sincerity of him really wanting to share the experience with them, I think.
What I want to ask both of you, how the art world beyond Kansas City, beyond people who knew him personally, how he's regarded now that he's no longer here, but he's still got exhibits in New York City. You know, like clearly this guy means something to the world of ceramics. And I'm wondering what that is. I'll start with you, John.
Well, he's sort of the father of contemporary ceramics. I mean, the moves that he made at that time period that Sherry was saying in the mid-50s, the way that universities are set up in the within ceramic departments, and not only ceramics, but sculpture and other studios, was innovated by what Volkos did down at Otis in the 50s. And
yeah,
that connection that was made at Black Mountain College with the abstract expressionism and the avant-garde was really, up until that moment, ceramics was thought of as a minor craft.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to have to jump in. Sherry Leedy, is there anything else you would add just quickly before we go?
Well, I would just reiterate what John has said, that Pete really changed the whole history of ceramics, and thank you very much, Mr. Volkos.
John Balestrieri,
yes,
former assistant to ceramist Peter Volkos, thank you. And Sherry Leedy, thank you too. Tomorrow, is Lawrence a blue bubble in a red state? We'll dig into the politics and culture of Lawrence, Kansas tomorrow on this show on KCUR's Central Standard. You can talk to us between now and then if you want to. We're at KCURCST on Twitter. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.